Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to MitoAction's monthly expert series. Today, Chad Glasser, Senior Director of Clinical Research at Tecentriq Therapeutics, and Dr. Amy Goldstein, Clinical Director of the Mitochondrial Medicine Frontier Program at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, are joining us to discuss Hope on the Horizon, the vital role of patients in clinical research. My name is Stephanie Harry. I'm one of the patient support coordinators at MitoAction and will be your host for today. Today's presentation will be recorded and available on MitoAction's website in the coming days, so please feel free to share this presentation with your friends or come back to have a review of this very important material. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the presentation using the Q&A feature in the bottom menu bar of your screen. Just a special note that the chat section is available if you want to chat with other participants, but it's really, really helpful if you can put all of your questions in the Q&A section so I don't miss them when we are sharing the questions with the clinicians. And we'll do our best to get to everyone's questions at the end of today's presentation. There is an unprecedented momentum in the mitochondrial disease clinical trial landscape, and the patient community plays a vital role in ensuring these trials have the potential to lead to new and effective treatments. This expert series aims to demystify clinical trial participation and answer your most pressing questions. Chad Glasser, PharmD, MPH, is the Senior Director of Clinical Research at Tecentriq Therapeutics. Chad has more than 12 years of clinical research experience, working on a range of preclinical to late-stage programs spanning infectious disease, oncology, and multiple rare disease therapeutic areas. For the last 5 years, he's focused on advancing Zagiskwad, which I mentioned to him earlier. I'm going to mispronounce it, but he will pronounce it correctly here soon. And he's currently working with Tecentriq on this compound. Dr. Goldstein is a child neurologist with a subspecialty focus and expertise in primary mitochondrial disorders. She has resided as the clinical director of the Mitochondrial Medicine Frontier Program since July 2017. Under her leadership, the Frontier Program has expanded clinical service to include inpatient consultations at CHOP, as well as the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania for adults. Dr. Goldstein is actively involved in direct patient care, clinical diagnosis, and management, striving to make ongoing improvements in patient care. She serves as a physician lead for retrospective and prospective natural history studies and interventional clinical trials. Dr. Goldstein is passionate about education and awareness and has served as a medical advisor for both MitoAction and UMDF, served as board member and past president of the Mitochondrial Medicine Society, and is a founding member of the Mitochondrial Care Network. So without further ado, we are so excited to have you, Chad and Dr. Goldstein, here to dive deep into these issues. And I know that there's a lot of questions in the community. So thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for your willingness to share about this topic.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us. I think it just kind of going back to the impetus for this webinar. So like Stephanie said, we do have an actively recruiting clinical study. And so we were having a conversation with Kyra about recruitment and some of the challenges and opportunities there. And we're really trying to understand what the patient community needs right now. And her response was, clinical trials are extremely complex. And if we can increase the community's understanding of their importance and what the goals are, hopefully making people a little bit more curious and maybe even a little bit more interested in participating, that would be a win-win. So it was something that we wanted to help facilitate and be a part of at Tecentriq. But I do want to say up front, I do have some slides, but I want to say up front that today's topic is not specific to Tecentriq. It's not meant to be, advocating for our study. The folks at MitoAction and Stephanie encouraged me to still share a few slides because we knew that there would be some questions about our trial. But I hope that your takeaway from this is that there's just a general call to action to get involved in any study. It doesn't have to be our study, any sponsored study. There's natural history studies and repositories and registries that Amy's going to talk about that are extremely important. And so hopefully this increases your interest in all of those things. So before I turn it over to Amy, the actual expert, I do have a few slides that will give you a bit of an overview of our study. So let me share those. Right. So our study is called PRISM. You can see where that name
You can't
Can you
see your
see? I
slides
cannot see
now.
these slides. Okay, let me try one more time. You actually rehearsed this before, so I thought it would be very easy. Okay,
It's
there we go.
coming.
All good? Okay. So like I said, our study is called PRISM. You can see where the name came from and what each letter represents. Typically, PRISM is spelled with an SM, but in this case, it is a ZM to represent Zagosawat because we're evaluating it in the context of MELAS. So we'll talk about kind of each aspect of this in a minute. And I know Amy will also kind of talk about what a number of these terms are. So one of the key takeaways I want everyone to have is that Tecentriq was really founded to further the development of this compound. As you heard from the intro, I've worked on this for the last 5 years or so, and this drug has been evaluated and explored in over 200 participants, healthies as well as other indications. So we have a lot of information, but we have found a home in mitochondrial disease. So we're really focused on MELAS initially and hopefully expanding that beyond. But one of the things we're trying to do to overcome some of the challenges, which again, Amy will talk about of clinical development, is really understand the disease and keep patient perspectives kind of at the front of a lot of those decisions. And so the first step for us was really understand the disease burden of MELAS as best we can. There's things like natural history studies that which are great to collect data over time, but they're challenging in rare disease, especially if it's heterogeneous, and they take a lot of time. But they're extremely important. So that's one aspect of understanding the disease burden. But another aspect that we incorporated is to talk to patients and understand what their disease experience is. And this has been done in broader primary mitochondrial disease and primary mitochondrial myopathy, but not necessarily specific to MELAS. So the goal of these interviews were to understand the signs, symptoms, and impacts of MELAS on a MELAS patient's, daily life. The next step is to really take all that information and select the right outcome measures. These are the assessments that we use in our study to make sure that we're measuring the aspects of disease that are important if you want to really evaluate whether your drug is working. And so we leveraged all of those insights, selected our outcome measures, and then incorporated them into our PRISM trial with the goal of evaluating efficacy. And so you can see that the symptoms that we are focusing on, fatigue, of course, as well as cognition, were some of the things that were coming up most frequently and as most bothersome in this patient interview study. So this was a really nice kind of progression of learning and iterative understanding of the disease experience to fine-tune our final study design. So in terms of the study design, the first two kind of keywords here, blinded and placebo-controlled, are similar to a lot of other late-stage studies. Blinded means that you don't know what you're receiving at any point, and placebo-controlled means that there is not only an active drug, but there's an inactive study drug that's administered. So that's similar to a number of other late-stage programs. I think what might be a little bit more unique about our trial is that it is a crossover design, and you can see here kind of what that looks like. So basically, 50% of patients will receive active drug, zagosiglat, and 50% will receive placebo over the course of 12 weeks. That's how long the first treatment period is. And then after a 4-week washout where no drug is administered, they will receive basically the opposite of what they received in period one for the same amount of time. This is advantageous because, again, the heterogeneity of the patient population is a key challenge. And so it allows us to compare within each subject kind of how they're doing on active and how they're doing on inactive, and increases our study power. These are the main criteria for eligibility, but of course this will be determined by the study doctor. So you need to be at least 18 years of age to 75, have a mitochondrial DNA mutation, does not have to be 3243, but does have to be an mtDNA mutation. Needs to have MELAS, so they have to have some sort of history of stroke-like episodes, and then also experience, the symptoms that we think are key and that we're going to be assessing in our trial. The features that we've incorporated trying to address some of the barriers that I know Amy's going to talk about to participating in clinical research are shown here. So concierge service to ensure that, the patients aren't responsible for scheduling all their visits and all of their travel. So this should make it a little bit more convenient. A key aspect of the study as well is that it's decentralized in many ways. So a lot of our key outcome measures are done at home electronically on their own device. So that does a couple of things. It decreases, hopefully, the length of many of the study visits, but it also allows for some of the study visits to be conducted in the patient's home. All patients will receive zagosiglat. So this is a little bit different because it is a crossover study compared to a 52-week placebo-controlled parallel study where when you're signing up, you know that there's a chance you might be receiving inactive drug for a longer period. So hopefully that's more attractive to patients. And then finally, there's an open label study that we're in the process of initiating at all of the sites that are participating. If a patient completes PRISM, then they may have the opportunity to receive longer-term study drug. This is my last slide. This is just a summary of all of the sites that we are working with. So there's 25, 26 sites. It's a global study across multiple countries. And I know Amy's going to talk a little bit more about kind of how to find this information online. If you are interested in learning more, that's our website at the bottom, tecentotx.com. There's the information I just shared, as well as some other, background on the molecule and other things that we're doing. That's the last thing I wanted to share. I want to turn it over to Amy. Again, I think Amy was a clear kind of winner in terms of who we wanted to target for this type of talk. And I know from my personal interactions with her how dedicated she is to the patient community and how much she cares. She's absolutely relentless in how much time and energy she puts into furthering the field. So she's the one that has the pulse on the community and kind of knows what they need to hear to feel more comfortable. So we wanted to give her free rein to discuss anything and everything she thought would be important for everyone to know right now with those goals in mind that Stephanie stated earlier. So I'm also excited to hear what she has to say. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to you, Amy, and thank you for doing this.
Okay, can you see my slides? Are you seeing my screen?
It's all good to go.
Okay, great. All right. Well, I want to thank Mito Action and Chad and Stephanie and Kyra for inviting me to be with you all today. As was said, I've been doing this for a long time. I finished my training in 2002. And in 2002, if we were suspicious of someone having a mitochondrial disease and actually able to name the gene, that was a huge success at that time. And treatment options were not even on the horizon, so to be able to start talking about clinical trials and outcome measures and what that would look like when that started becoming more routine in conversation. And I think that was really more common about 15 years ago at the meetings. I thought that this is now a game changer. But what has happened is that we still really don't have an FDA-approved medication for primary mitochondrial disease, although we've seen some movement here. There's an FDA-approved medicine for fatty acid oxidation disorders. There's an FDA-approved medication for Friedreich's ataxia, which is a mitochondrial disorder, but it's extremely restricted to that disorder alone. And we know that the FDA is going to review elamipretide for Barth syndrome. It got moved from the end of January to now the end of April. So we're seeing progress in this area. There will be there are right now several trials open, and we hope to see in 2025 a few more trials opening. And so we thought this would be a great time to talk about clinical trials, and the vital role that patients have in participating in clinical trials. So I'm going to go through some slides, but we do want to have lots of time at the end for questions. So just to review, there are many symptoms of primary mitochondrial disease. And on the left is a graphic that's taken from a paper by Grainne Gorman. And Grainne Gorman is a neurologist at what I like to call the mothership of mitochondrial disease, Newcastle upon Tyne in the United Kingdom. They have a wonderful center there for mito. And one of my goals on my bucket list was to go visit them one day. And I was able to go visit their center. But this paper was from 2016, and this is just really nice graphic showing how multi-systemic mitochondrial disease can be. There are a lot of neurologic symptoms because the brain and the spinal cord and the peripheral nerves and the muscle take a lot of energy to run. And then, of course, there are a lot of non-neurologic symptoms, anything from the heart, the gut, the sex organs, the pancreas, the endocrine organs. All of this can also be involved. And every patient can be different, and you can have the same mitochondrial disorder as other people in your family, and the symptoms might be similar, and the symptoms might be very different. And so this can become part of the challenge when we start doing trials, because if people have different symptoms, even if they have the same disorder, how are we going to measure the outcomes, right? So it becomes challenging. On the right side of the screen, and sorry, it's a little fuzzy, it says symptoms of primary mitochondrial disease. And on the left side, where all the blue bars are, it says experienced symptoms reported by primary mitochondrial disease subjects. And this was 290 patients that were asked, what are your top symptoms? And the top five are muscle weakness, chronic fatigue, exercise and intolerance, gastrointestinal, and imbalance. And then people were asked, how would you prioritize those symptoms for trial participation? In other words, if we could make something better, if we had a drug to make your symptoms better, which symptoms would you want to have made better by that drug? And people picked those same top five symptoms. And I should say that these were adults that were asked this question. And this is a paper published by the CHOP group. Dr. Zuela Zolkipli Cunningham is the lead author on that paper. And so this also gave us a good idea about what's important to the patients. Because again, this is really, really important to find out what do patients find important as far as their symptoms are concerned, and what medications should we be trying to target? What treatments do we need to be trying to develop to treat those symptoms that are most important for our patients? This is a paper that is quite old. It goes back to 2013. But at the time, this paper really spoke to me, and I'm going to show you why in their closing statements. And this was written by many people throughout different centers, a lot of Europeans, but also some people from American centers, including Michio Hirano at Columbia and Vamsi Mutha at Harvard. But this paper is called "No Treatments, New Treatments for Mitochondrial Disease: No Time to Drop Our Standards." And the reason that this paper was written is because there were many treatments that were coming up, and a lot of patients said, oh, that's available on Amazon. Let me just order it. And people were taking things that were not quite tested. Some people wanted to try to test them, but there wasn't an opportunity to, because all of a sudden, again, with Amazon and with social media, people said, oh, this is now available. Let me go grab this. And there wasn't an opportunity to follow side effects, efficacy, who did it help, who did it not help, and what symptoms might it be beneficial for, and what symptoms did it not help. And so I'll show you in the closing statements what their words of wisdom were that are still very pertinent for today. But before the closing statements, they also did a quick literature review. And what they showed then, which again is still true now, is that over 47 years, there were over 1,000 studies that are published in the literature. And these are failed treatment trials for mitochondrial disease. And there were only 35 studies at that time that included more than five patients. You need to include more than five patients in a study. So when Chad went through the study that's open right now for Tecento, he showed they're recruiting 44 patients. Where do these numbers come from? Well, there's a lot of statistics that go into designing a clinical trial. It needs to be what we call powered, so that we can prove that once you have a drug effect showing that the people that are on drug versus placebo, that you can show that there's a difference. And so when you do all of that pre-work ahead of time and you work with the statistician, they can say, it looks like you're going to need this many patients to be able to show that difference. So it's very important to have more than five patients in a study, for sure. So the closing statements, and again, this was kind of a more or less a warning for the community that leading mitochondrial physicians should set the example and avoid overemphasis on the theoretical benefits of unproven treatments. And this includes the mito cocktail. This was kind of a little tisk-tisk to the US physicians like me who continue to show the benefits or to talk about benefits of a mito cocktail, which is still unproven. No one's ever proved that the cocktail works in a randomized controlled trial. I'll talk about what those words mean in a few slides, but also that the patient groups, including groups like MitoAction, can better educate their members to engage in high quality research and controlled trials. That's why MitoAction hosts meetings like this. And both the physicians and the support groups should work collaboratively with industry, people like Chad and Tisento, in well-powered multi-center randomized controlled trials. So, in other words, this is a collaborative effort. We all want to be working together to make this happen together. We realize that we need to be working collaboratively. And only by doing this will we make headway in developing treatments for these currently incurable diseases. So this needs to be a patient community, an advocacy group community, the physician community, and other clinicians, as well as industry. And then, of course, partnering with groups like the FDA, the EMA, and whatever country you're in, that governing body. So, of course, there's some obstacles here, right? What diseases should we treat? I saw a question come in for Chad. Are they going to be looking at people who have mutations that don't have MELAS? Why are they going after MELAS specifically? There are a lot of trials that have been there, done that, and failed. And a lot, when you look at some of the treatments that have already been published and have not met their outcome measures, it's possibly because we said anyone with a primary mitochondrial disease can be in the study. And then the symptoms were so different that it was hard to show a signal that anyone improved because the symptoms were so different. So we said maybe we need to be recruiting not only people with the same genotype or similar genotypes, similar mutations, but the same phenotype. So maybe it needs to be everybody that has MELAS or everybody that has Kearns-Sayre syndrome with ptosis and ophthalmoplegia, and we go after those certain symptoms, or everyone with primary mitochondrial myopathy that have weakness, exercise intolerance, and can only walk a certain distance on a 6-minute walk. So again, that's the similar phenotype. And then what outcomes to measure? So I just mentioned the 6-minute walk. Is that really important? Does that measure your exercise intolerance? I have so many patients that said, you want me to walk in 6 minutes? I'll come in and walk in 6 minutes and I can walk over 450 meters. But then come find me 2 hours later and I'll show you how tired I am. Or come find me the next day and do you have a measure to measure my post-exercise malaise yet? Because that's what we really need to be measuring. So again, we need to get really good at understanding from our community, how are you suffering from this disease? We also have this long and unpredictable course with an unknown natural history, and there are now several natural history studies in place so that we can try to understand what happens. And there is another drug that's been out there for a very long time that I will name. It used to be called Epi-743, and then it changed to PTC-743, and it used to be made by Edison Pharmaceuticals. And again, the drug company name has changed several times. I think it is now PTC. Matt Klein is the has been the CEO of that company for a long time. Some people are still on this drug. Vatiquinone, I believe, is the name of the drug. And when it first was in trials for Leigh syndrome, they were recruiting children that were in their last 6 months of life because we thought Leigh syndrome, these children are not going to survive very long. And when they went to, and what happened was in the very first trial, children survived and everyone said, this drug is it. Because look, we all thought these children were not going to make it for another 6 months. They all survived. Let's do another trial and let's recruit children that show a decline within the last year. And those are the children we want to put in this trial. And they had trouble recruiting because they couldn't find enough children that had shown decline within that past year. And everyone started questioning, well, doesn't everyone with Leigh syndrome have a decline within that last year? Why can't we find enough kids to bring into the study? And certainly there were children that had a regression or a decline within the last year, but many kids had been stable over the past year. So again, when you've been doing it for a long time, seasoned physicians like Russ Sonito and Bruce Cohen, we started thinking maybe we don't know enough about this disease as we thought we did. We need to understand this natural history a little bit better. And we sat down and we, along with Kyra Mann and other support groups, we said we need a Leigh syndrome roadmap and we need to do this natural history study. And that's currently in place right now. Another thing that I like to talk about is that there's what's called the preclinical trial, which is the lab evidence. What happens when you give the drug to the worms and the fish and the flies and the mice or cells in a dish? So there can be lab evidence that the drug works versus what happens when you put it into a living human person in vivo. And this is what I like to call the vagus phenomenon, right? Like, so what happens in the dish stays in the dish, and it really doesn't translate into what happens when you put it in a person. So the opposite can be true, which is that sometimes we talk about drug toxicity, and what about all these drugs that are supposed to be harmful to our mitochondria? Yes, if you add many things to a dish of mitochondria, the mitochondria can look like they're poisoned. That doesn't necessarily happen when you give them to people in vivo. And I can take questions about that later because I know that comes up a lot. Another question that comes up is which form of medication should we be giving? An activated form, an inactivated form, and then let the body activate it with our own enzymes. And a good example of this is using niacin type of vitamins. So there's a big conversation right now about what niacin vitamin is the best one to give. There's a lot of talk out there about NAD plus, or do we want to give niacin, but that causes flushing and some uncomfortableness, so people don't like niacin. Well, then what about niacinamide? But then you see nicotinamide or nicotinamide riboside. I mean, it goes on and on. And is one better for your muscle and one better for your brain? So there's all these different forms of medication. And so that is also translatable to other types of medication. We've seen for some of the other drugs, you can't always take drugs orally. Some of these need to be injected because they're peptides and they might get broken down by the stomach acid. So the delivery system is also important. Then we have problems with difficulty meeting entry criteria. And I think for our mito population, one of the biggest issues has been having a genetic confirmation of mitochondrial disease. And there are many people, especially people who were worked up 10, 20 years ago, who said, I have a muscle biopsy. I have proven complex one deficiency. And that's as far as I got. And my insurance company wouldn't pay for exome or they wouldn't pay for more testing. So this is all I have. Why can't I get into a trial? And the trials started getting very, very specific that you had to have genetic confirmation because we wanted to make sure that we knew who we were recruiting, that we weren't bringing people into a trial that might have secondary mitochondrial dysfunction and their complex one deficiency was from a different primary genetic disease. Then we have the burden on the patients. There's cost, there's travel, and then there's also clinical trial fatigue. I had patients bouncing from one trial and they left that trial, they were right into another trial. Then they were out of that trial, they went back into another trial. And before you knew it, they're like, this is too exhausting. They couldn't do another trial. It was too much. So there are burdens that are involved, especially when you live far away from some of these sites. And Chad addressed some of this, like what burdens can we take off of the patient to be able to participate in this trial? How much can we do at home? How much coordinating can we do so that some of that burden is lifted? There's a role of the FDA and the patient advocacy groups, and there have been many planning meetings talking with the FDA, and the advocacy groups have gone to bat and had a lot of these discussions. And I'm just going to highlight one of these. There was a mitochondrial disease externally led patient-focused drug development meeting in 2019, and then further talks with the FDA. And this was really to help bring consensus on what's important to include in clinical trials. goals, and to also help build some more infrastructure to support international multi-center trials. And again, this was a huge effort, Mito Action with the UMDF, and also talking to the International Mitochondrial Patient Group, Mito Foundation in Australia, Mito Canada, the Lilly Foundation in the UK. So there are a lot of good solutions to good trial design, understanding the disease mechanisms through the robust preclinical models. So that having an animal model of the disease and the drug effect on that preclinical model is vitally important. Looking to the past to help improve that clinical trial design. Again, we've got over 1,000 trials that have failed. We have to learn from that history. Engaging patients and families and the support groups to prioritize the symptoms and goals for the trials, and communicating early and often with industry and the FDA, and using the correct outcome measures to show the treatment effect. And for me, this is all about communicating with the patient. Is what we're measuring the right thing? Or do you think this, what we're measuring is the wrong thing? And again, I've had that conversation so many times with patients when they come in and we have a conversation about either the 6-minute walk or they're filling out the survey. Are we capturing your symptoms, yes or no? And it's been really eye-opening for me when someone's finished filling out a survey and I say, is there anything else you want me to tell the company that you're feeling that we didn't capture on the survey? And I've been able to write that down and say, I'm going to tell them what you just said, because I think that what I'm able to tell them with quotation marks around it in the patient's own words, for me, I feel like that means more than a survey. Now, the surveys are important, of course, but having somebody's words, and especially that hasn't already been captured in any other way, I feel like that's vitally important. I also feel it's very important, and I do this to make sure my patients are trial ready, maximizing their health prior to the trial. If somebody's not in good shape, it is not a great idea to bring them into a trial. If I can optimize their health first, I'm not going to do the trial any favors by bringing somebody in who's not in good shape, right? So I want to make sure that they're on a good Mito cocktail, assuming the trial allows that, right? Most trials do, as long as you don't change a lot. But also making sure their nutrition is adequate, that their mobility is good, that if they need any other help, like with, for example, AFOs to help with their mobility, but also that their sleep is good and that their mood is good. And I'm going to talk about that too. Again, steps to clinical trial design. We want to understand the natural history. We want to select the optimal outcome measures, and we want to make sure that when we're designing the trial, that we understand what barriers might be in place for the patients, and that we're trying to add as many centers as we can to reach patients that are in different geographical locations, maybe different ethnic backgrounds, so that we're including different centers. And international is also very helpful. What about the role of the patient? So as soon as a patient is getting recruited into a trial, we no longer call you the patient. You're now the subject, right? And I think the lingo here is very important, because when I start asking my patients, are you interested in hearing more about a clinical trial? And they say yes. I say, okay, I'm going to bring in my clinical trial coordinator, because I still want to be the physician who's taking care of you. And I also don't want there to be any perception that I am forcing or coercing someone to participate in a trial. I'm still going to be your doctor, whether you say yes or no. And I really want there to be a sense that this is voluntary. I am offering this to you, but I don't want you to feel forced into this at all. Research is voluntary, and your consent is absolutely required, right? Your participation is voluntary, but also by consent. You should be signing a form saying, I agree to participate, that someone's read it to you, that you understand it, you've had time to read the consent form and ask questions. And children should be assented. And there's a line on our form that children can sign that assent line. There is protection for subjects that are undergoing research, and there are special populations. Children is one of them. Prisoners are another special population. And research needs to undergo heavy ethical consideration in any institution through the IRB or the Institutional Review Board. And this is a serious, serious business, right? We need to make sure that we're not putting people through undue pain, undue procedures. So this all has to get prior approval from the hospital setting. But we do want our subjects, once they're enrolled in research, to comply with the study protocol. If you're on drug or placebo, to stick to that, to fill out any surveys, to come to the visits to the best of your ability, and to maintain your health, including any other medications that you're taking, maintain your nutrition, maintain your sleep, and maintain your mood. And to notify the study team of any changes or adverse events, side effects, or positive changes, especially if you don't think these are otherwise being measured. I just wanted to say a word about the types of different clinical trials. So there's a treatment trial, and we've really been talking about that, either medication or a device or a combination of drugs. It could even be surgery or radiation. And treatment trials are categorized by phases one, two, and three, and I'll talk about that on the next slide. But there can also be a prevention trial, so great ways of preventing or reducing your risk of disease. We've also mentioned natural history studies. So a natural history study is not an intervention, but just following the natural course of disease. And some people call this also like following the clinical course, because sometimes we are doing interventions that we would want to do naturally, but we're not just letting the disease run without doing any medical interventions, right? We're treating symptoms, we're offering other treatments. But the natural history is watching what happens over the course of time, but without doing anything experimental. And we're following again along what happens over the course of time. If you're getting an MRI, what does that look like? If you're having any other tests, what are the results of that test so that we can follow progression over time? Diagnostic clinical trial is so that we can better develop tests or procedures. So one of my partners, Rebecca Ganetsky, is developing new tests all the time in our lab. And so when people come in, we may say, oh, do you mind if we draw an extra few tubes of blood? We're trying to develop a new test in the lab. And people may say, that's fine, go ahead. While I'm going to the lab, go ahead and draw an extra few tubes of blood. And that goes off to the lab for drug for test development. There could be screening, so new ways of detecting disease earlier in healthy people. And then there can be quality of life trials. So how can we better improve your comfort or quality of life with chronic illness? And then I just want to say a word about expanded access. And Chad talked about this as it relates to his trial. So there can be this kind of open access at the end of a treatment trial, or what's called expanded access. So expanded access, or kind of this open access at the trial means that this is experimental therapy, so it's not yet approved. And this can be either at the end of a randomized controlled trial or directly. Some drugs can be offered whether you've been through a randomized controlled trial or not. You can just be put on expanded access before a medication is approved by the FDA. And that is at no cost to you, because it is not it's not available through insurance. It's not FDA approved, but a drug company is making it available, and it's usually not as stringent as being on a clinical trial. In other words, we're not usually collecting as much data as you would be when you're in a randomized clinical trial where you're coming in for a set number of visits and collecting all of this information. So phases of a clinical trial, stage zero is preclinical, again, in the lab on either animal models or cells in a dish. Phase one is safety. So this is usually in healthy volunteers, just to make sure a new drug or intervention is safe, and are there any side effects? And then phase two is safety and dosing. So usually this is a little bit larger, and this is to again for safety, but also what's the effective dose of the treatment? And then phase three is usually much larger than phase two, and again this is usually randomized, controlled, And I'm going to talk about what those mean in a minute. But this is a little bit larger scale, and again, more to confirm any benefit or the effectiveness of a trial, and then a continued safety information. And then phase four is post-approval. And this is, sometimes people call this post-marketing. But what else is happening as the drug's gotten approved? Are there anything else that we need to know about the drug now that it's been given on a longer scale? So I wanted to talk a little bit about what happened at the FDA meeting, this patient-focused drug development meeting. The FDA wanted to hear the patient perspective. They want to hear about this. A lot of different disease groups go to the FDA for these focused meetings. And so there was one for mitochondrial disease, and there were two main goals for this: to provide the patient perspective to the FDA by providing testimony, discuss key topics, and identify treatment priorities, and then to capture patient-provided data to help inform clinical trials. So there were two parts of the day. There was adult half in the morning, and then a pediatric part in the afternoon. And in the morning, Dr. Michio Hirano spoke to the FDA and discussed all the information that he could about adult care. And then there were five adults that spoke to the FDA about their experience with mitochondrial disease. And then in the afternoon, I spoke to the FDA about pediatric disease. And then five parents spoke to the FDA about their experience with their children. So what did we learn? The adults talked about their most important symptoms and what specifically their issues were with their activities of daily living, and what their most concerning issues were as they went about their day for social, emotional, or economic consequences. And the end result was new treatments needed to focus on the unmet needs, reducing fatigue, reducing muscle weakness, reducing pain, GI problems, and exercise intolerance, gaining function, slowing or stopping disease progression would be meaningful. Prolongation of life would be important, but not the primary focus. And adult myopathy patients would most likely use a new medication or participate in a trial based on a lack of side effects, which was most important to the adult community, cost, the burden of administration, and common side effects. And then for pediatric patients, again, we review the important symptoms, what was the most impactful symptoms on the activities of daily life, and what impacted them socially, emotionally, and economically. And then, as far as new treatments and what would meet their unmet needs, reducing fatigue and weakness, improving GI issues, speech, seizures, pain and movement disorders, and swallowing, gaining function, and prolonging life was very important. And then caregivers and pediatric patients would most likely participate in a trial. Again, lack of serious side effects, burden of administration, common side effects, length of treatment, cost and travel. So this was very important information to have in moving forward. Just a few definitions. So recruiting means it's open for new participants. Participation criteria, eligibility criteria, Chad mentioned this a little bit when he talked about his trial. Inclusion criteria means you have to have these features to participate, but it's also then very important to know what are the exclusion criteria. Any of those features, you would not be able to participate. And a lot of those are based on safety criteria for the study. So this usually covers if somebody had significant heart disease, kidney disease, or liver disease. A randomized controlled double-blind trial is the gold standard of trials, and this is usually a treatment, meaning a drug, versus a placebo, and that's determined by random chance. So, it's like a flip of a coin. When you enter a trial, you're either going to get the treatment or the placebo, and it's usually a computer-generated thing of which one you're going to get. The blinded part, the double-blinded, means that the study team, including your physician and you, do not know which one you are receiving. You are blinded to whether you're getting treatment or placebo, and that is to avoid any bias, because if anybody knows what you're getting, you might decide that you're doing better or you're doing worse. A lot of the studies are designed either as crossover or a parallel design. So parallel means you're either on the treatment the entire time or you're on the placebo the entire time. And the crossover, if you notice during Chad's presentation, that's a crossover design. You're on treatment. And that first random, again, randomly, you're either on one or the other, and then you go through a short washout where you're on nothing, and then you go on the opposite, and then vice versa. If you were on the placebo first, you're on that first, and then you go through a washout where you're on nothing, and then you're on the opposite, then you go on the treatment arm. And so the benefit of being in a crossover design is that you get exposed one way or the other to the treatment. If you're in the parallel arm design, you're on one or the other. What's very nice about a lot of the treatments, a lot of the clinical trials, is that even if it's a parallel arm design, at the end, they may offer you that open label extension, meaning even if you were only on placebo the whole time, you may get offered that open label at the end. So you'll definitely get drug at the end of the trial. And then again, we've been talking about outcome measures. Outcome measures is what exactly is being measured during the trial to determine any response to the therapy or side effects during the trial, especially to how you feel, function, or survive. And those are the key things that are very important to the FDA. It turns out the FDA doesn't care about things like a lactate measurement in your blood if it doesn't correlate to how you feel or how you function. Right. So we could have a drug that lowers your lactate, and they're like, we don't care if it doesn't help your patient feel better. They really care about you feeling better, which is it's kind of nice, actually. All right. How do you find clinical trials? The websites have made this very easy because some of us have given them feedback that it was hard to find the clinical trials on the webpage. So we thank them for making it easier. So if you go to, whoop, sorry, if you go to MitoAction, you can go to current clinical trials and you can see all these boxes that, you can see them by different names of the companies. And then also you can look up different disorders on the web page and then it'll guide you to the clinical trial. You can also look this up on the UMDF web page by the name of the company. You can also go, this is the standard place that we go to, clinicaltrials.gov. And if you bring this up, clinicaltrials.gov. The first thing that you want to do, you can see condition disease, and you want to type in mitochondrial disease in this box. If you know the intervention or the treatment, you can put that in. If you know the location, you can put that in. But you're going to get a really long list here. And so some of them will say recruiting, some might say by invitation only, which usually means you are already in a trial and you're getting invited back for the next level of that trial. Some might say open, not yet recruiting. Some might say completed. Some might say terminated. So you have to kind of watch and see the detail of what comes next after you go through your search bar. If you just type in mitochondrial disease in search, you're going to get a lot. So you want to try to narrow this down by putting in the name of the company or the name of the drug here, or at least by location, because this will pull up all locations, including Europe, and you may not be eligible for treatments in other countries. So I think that was my last slide. I'm going to stop sharing so that we have time for questions.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It's definitely a beautiful plethora of information, and we've had some wonderful questions come through. One I wanted to start with in regards to the endpoints. You mentioned the walk test and how sometimes those endpoints aren't as helpful as we had hoped. Can you describe a bit how endpoints are decided and how can the types of endpoints that don't feel helpful be changed?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a lot of the endpoints are historical, meaning that we know that the FDA loves certain endpoints and they love the 6-minute walk test. Like that's a gold standard for the FDA. And when we're designing these trials, that remember that the trials get approved, right? And the trials get approved not only by the IRB, but they also get approved. We talk not only again as a physician, and I'm going to let Chad talk about answer this question as well. We talk to the drug company. We talk, a lot of them now partner with us in terms of designing the trials. So we talk to industry, we talk to the FDA, and we say, what's going to be the best measurement to determine whether this drug is going to get approved or not based on, what we find out? Again, there have been historically drugs that have gotten approved based on the 6-minute walk test. The question is that the best measurement for mitochondrial disease, yes or no? And I think that a lot of us are thinking this may not be the best measurement, right? It might be great for Duchenne muscular dystrophy when people are still walking, but this is a different disease and it may not capture what we need it to capture. And so I'll just say, in my group, one of the things that we're looking at is that there may need to be a composite score, right? And so something that Doctors O'Kipley Cunningham has been working on for a very long time is using the 6-minute walk along with an ataxia measurement, along with fine motor, along with a fatigue scale, along with a quality of life scale, along with muscle strength testing, and and getting this composite score, and she calls it the MMCOAST, and that paper's been published, and looking at something more along those lines, because again, there are many people with mitochondrial myopathy that have no trouble completing a 6-minute walk test. That does not mean that they're not fatigued or have exercise intolerance. And so we're not capturing it well on a 6-minute walk, right? Yeah. So, Chad, do you have anything to add about that using the 6-minute walk or, how you select your outcome measures?
Yeah, I mean, I'm also not a big fan of 6-minute walk tests, based on a number of reasons. But I think, from the agency's perspective, I think what we know is like they want an endpoint that or an outcome measure that they can easily interpret a change in. And if they've used that in tons of other indications and they know a 30-meter change or a 50-meter change is meaningful, then they think, oh, well, we could put that in a different indication. And then if you hit that, then your drug works. And to Amy's point, it's not a one size fits all. And so we're also looking at kind of a composite assessment in our study too, because everyone has a different level of cognitive slowing and fatigue and all of these things. And so by combining them into like an MMCOAST type measure, we're able to hopefully capture a broader range of symptoms and be more applicable to the broader population. So outcome measures is the number one, to me, the number one challenge of everything that we're doing beyond defining your patient population. So it's a great question.
So it sounds like because of the history that the composite score is almost the way that you have to go because you can't completely take out the 6-minute walk test and replace it with something else because that something else hasn't necessarily been evaluated or existed or have like the standard in the FDA's mind as the 6-minute walk test. Am I understanding that correctly?
I mean, the burden is on us. It's the burden is on, Zoella Chop and others to like defend the MMCOAST of like, here's the measurement properties of that. And then for us, we have to defend why, our effect sizes for each one of these outcome measures we chose is appropriate and relevant. So there's a whole dossier that, we're in the process of building to educate the agency as in terms of why this makes sense for the indication.
We're talking a little bit about like the whole defending and kind of processing that. One of the things that you talked about, because you guys do have a washout study, I'm curious, how do you decide how long that washout period is? You chose 4 weeks. What's 4 weeks versus 6 weeks versus 8 weeks? Like, how do you decide how long you need to wait in order for it to be washed out?
Yeah, it's there's a lot that goes into that, and that was a conversation we had with the agency. I think that's one of the things when you're thinking about a crossover, it's a key aspect of the design is how long that period is. It's primarily related to the pharmacokinetics of our drug, so kind of the exposure that we expect of that drug, and also the mechanism, meaning how quick on and quick off is the mechanism. So if you were to take the drug away, how long would you expect any sort of effects to last? And so we have some data. We know a lot about this mechanism that's been around for many, many years. But it's a combination of when will all of the drug kind of be out of your system, and when do you think any sort of effects of the drug would be gone? And 4 weeks is really the point where we feel confident that that's the case.
So another patient asked, She asked first to clarify if the Mito cocktail is specific for each person. And then also, if you're on a Mito cocktail, how does that affect your ability to join a trial? Do some trials let you stay on your cocktail? Do other trials not? The trial that you talked about, Chad, what are the parameters with that, if you know?
I'll let Amy talk about the cocktail specifically for each patient. We have tried to make this, again, we don't want to rock the boat. We know that we're already rocking the boat by asking patients to participate in clinical research so they can continue all of their Mito cocktail, supplements for our study. So that's not a, there's no need for a washout. We're not excluding them based on that. But Amy, you can comment on the other part.
Sure. So we personalize the cocktail at CHOP, and there is a paper that came out from our group. The first author is Isabella Barcelos, and we have kind of a core group of vitamins that we use, and then we will add on to that based on symptoms or what the defect is. So, for example, if somebody has Kearns-Sayre syndrome or Golgi, we know that they typically have a cerebral folate deficiency that goes along with that. So we'll add on folinic acid. Or if somebody has migraines, we'll add on riboflavin to help with their migraines. If somebody has MELAS, we will add on arginine because we like our patients on prophylactic arginine. So we will personalize it based on that. And then we will also personalize it based on some of the newer lab tests that I had talked about Dr. Ganetsky working on. So at CHOP, we are able to measure total and oxidized glutathione, which is a measure of reactive oxygen and so an oxidative stress. So if somebody has a low glutathione, we will be able to not only put them on N-acetylcysteine, but also to keep measuring that to make sure that they're on enough N-acetylcysteine. And if their oxidized glutathione is high, we can add on other antioxidants like vitamin E or alpha lipoic acid. So it's not for us just guesswork anymore about the amount. We can actually measure these things. And we also have a new blood test called a ketone body panel, which also helps us know how much niacin or whatever niacin vitamin our patient will tolerate. Usually we're using niacinamide at CHOP. And so again, that blood test helps us understand how much niacinamide our patient should be on. Or if our patient has a complex one defect, it can really be helpful in terms of measuring that blood test. So, the bottom line is that our patients are on a personalized mitochondrial medicine regimen. And we're trying to get away from calling it a cocktail, which makes it sound like, a little too much fun and a little too like extra, because we really do feel that this, mitochondrial medicine regimen is helpful. It's supporting the electron transport chain. This is serious business, and we don't want to make it sound too fluffy, right? And even though it hasn't been in a randomized controlled trial, and even though many insurance companies don't want to pay for it, this is not like somebody who's healthy taking a one-a-day vitamin. These are people with a deficit that are trying to support their mitochondria.
Thank you so much for that clarification. The patient also asked in regards to, because you mentioned patient fatigue with trials, but then sometimes there is not clarity around, like, can you participate in more than one? Or if you've participated in one recently, can you participate in a different one if there's overlap with, how does that work?
I am so glad somebody asked this question, because one of the things I forgot to say is that you can't be in more than one trial at the same time. This is not a good idea, right? Because sometimes there's just too much noise, right? How are we going to know what's working? And so one of the things that I think that maybe 10 years ago there were people that were saying you got to come off your cocktail, and a lot of patients were like, well, you can't take that away from me, I'm not going to do the trial. And then we said, well, we've got to let people stay on their cocktail, right? Their mitochondrial medicine regimen. But how about no changes, unless it's like, absolutely necessary, or there's something like earth-shattering that we have to do some changes. Try to maintain what you're on, Right. And I've had patients come in and there were kind of rules about their trial, like no changes can be made at all. But then I'd have to call the company saying, well, this kid is having seizures. I'm changing the seizure medicine. Like, let's not be ridiculous, right? Like, we have to make certain changes. But for the most part, you want to try not to make a lot of changes, right? We can't have too much noise. But absolutely no way can you start one trial of an experimental medication and then try to enroll in a second trial at the same time. Like, how are we ever going to figure out anything? So that's also part of the patient responsibilities. And I'm not trying to throw anybody under the bus here, but there are a few patients, not named, not I'm not going to name any names, of course, but like there are some people that, again, I know where it's coming from. There are people who are really suffering out there, and like there's some desperation. Like, and if I hear like, oh my goodness, somebody just heard about something great and I can buy that on Amazon and I want to take that too, but I'm on a drug trial. Like I just found out somebody was taking something else that they bought from Amazon, but they're in one of my trials. And I'm like, oh man, how did that just add to our, like, what do we do with that information now? Because it's noise. And now it's like, well, now what do we do? Did that wreck the trial? Like, it's a variable, it's an unexpected variable. And did it, is that now why the kid is better or worse? Or, I don't know. And so it's, we're trying to prove that these drugs work. And until we have an approved drug, we want to keep the noise at a minimum. And it's such a hard thing for me to say because I appreciate my patients are suffering. I really do. And listen, I mean, I get the desperation. I want everyone feeling better also. But this temptation to grab the new shiny thing on Amazon, if you're in a drug trial, please try not to do that. Or make sure that we know about it and, be transparent about it, because that's the harm here, is that we're not going to know if these drugs work, and we're not going to get anything approved if there's too much noise. All right, I'll get off my soapbox now.
No, I think it's really important because you did a really good job at kind of sharing and explaining both sides. Because, and I like how you talk about the variables as noise, because a lot of times, like, when we think of variables, we might think of our sixth grade science class, and you don't necessarily think through actually how many variables exist, even when you're trying to minimize them, let alone when we add extra too, and how that makes it more difficult in the long run. But I also appreciate the fact that you understand, like, it's hard. It's hard as patients, as parents, to watch our kids or ourselves like suffer. And yet it's important for us to also know that in the long run, like, this is not eliminating the suffering by adding extra variables if we're part of trials that because you have to keep that noise at a minimum to really know what's working and what's not. So it's a very important thing to be discussed, and I really appreciate how you discussed that. So another thing, so as we're talking about discussions and as you're talking about communication between the patients, like, you're so good at talking with patients and you're so good at explaining things and asking those extra questions. Let's say I am a patient that is participating in a trial that isn't with you, and take a survey that I realize after the survey it hasn't captured what I had hoped it would capture. Who do I mention that to? Or who do I, and can I request, like, hey, can you please add this somewhere? Because I feel like this is really important.
So for sure, you can talk to your clinical trial coordinator, and if you're in a trial, you always have that person's phone number, always. And you usually also have a contact at the drug company, and so on clinicaltrials.gov, when I look at, here's who you contact if you want to participate. Again, there's somebody at the site where you're participating, and there usually is a contact at the company. But if you're actively participating in a trial, I would say contact your clinical trial coordinator.
Okay.
I
I think one of the things that we're proud of that we're doing in our study is we do have exit interviews at the end of the crossover. So it's an open-ended one to learn about, like, what did they like about the study? What did they not like about the study? What was difficult? What was easy? Would you do it again? But also, like, how is your disease changed, and again, getting quotes and their perspectives of that. And again, it's probably not going to be in the terms of some of the measures that we're using, but it's outside of that, and it would inform our next stage of development. So we're proactively capturing that within our protocol.
So another patient asked, are there next steps for someone with a primary mitochondrial genetically diagnosed condition, but there's no active trials? Like, what do you do, I guess, in the weight game? Is there something that's, if you have a genetic confirmation, but you go to clinical trials and there's nothing there, like, do you have any words of advice or wisdom for those patients?
Absolutely. So more trials are coming. They are on the horizon. I mean, I feel like I keep saying that, but there are so many trials that are coming, and there are ways to keep current with that, right? MitoAction is always having a webinar about, what's coming on the horizon, or it's on the web page. The UMDF does similar, right? And I think you both do a great job, making sure that you're spreading all of the awareness to the community. I think, again, clinicaltrials.gov is a little harder to navigate, which is why I really like people to rely on the support groups for this information. And there are recorded talks on this as well. So if you're not sure what's happening, you can always go to the websites and see is there a recorded webinar on this, or to call, right? There's phone numbers to call the support groups and say, I'm having trouble. Is there, what's the latest? When can I find out what's going to be available for me, so that you can keep current on the clinical trials? And if you are interested in participating in a clinical trial, I want to encourage you to keep yourself trial ready. And again, I can't emphasize that enough, because you want to make sure that you are as healthy as you can be. A lot of the trial, and now this is always hard, right? Nobody wants to end up in the hospital, but one of the exclusion criteria is no hospitalizations within 30 days, right? So you want to try not to be hospitalized if you can help it. It sounds so silly for me to say that, because nobody wants to be in the hospital. And one of the slides I didn't show, but this was really earth-shattering for me, is the importance of mood, right? So I did a lot of investigating last year on some of the psychiatric manifestations of having mitochondrial disease and the impact of having depression and anxiety on your other symptoms. And when you, if you're in a clinical trial, even if you're not, even if you're just going to your doctor and your doctor's saying, how are your symptoms? If you're in a bad mood that day, you're going to report that your symptoms are a lot worse. And if you're in a good mood that day, you're going to report that your symptoms are a lot better. And this has been proven. Like, somebody has studied this. This is a paper in press that it's been published, actually. We now know this, that the impact of your mood on your symptoms can make all the difference. So I'm telling my patients, like, I want to make sure that your depression, if you have depression and anxiety, that you're treating it. Because if you then participate in a clinical trial and your depression or anxiety isn't treated, we could have a good drug and it's going to look really bad, because you're in a bad mood and you're telling on the survey that your symptoms aren't better, and maybe they are, but your depression isn't treated, right? So again, we have to know all these caveats now about, how every single symptom our patients have might play out when we're looking at all the outcome measures, including a patient-reported outcome measure about whether their symptoms are better. And this isn't just like, are you in a good mood or not? This is how, how's your kidney disease today, right? Or how is your ataxia today? And if you're in a bad mood, you're going to say, my balance is terrible, versus a good mood. So this is really important to know. And same thing with your sleep. If you're not sleeping well, we've got to try to fix your sleep. If your nutrition's bad, we've got to try to fix, so again, optimizing good health to keep you clinical trial ready.
That sounds very complicated, right? Because it's a little like, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? Isn't for some people, because if you're in pain, you're not going to be in a great mood. But if they kind of coexist with each other. How do you decipher between the two? Or it's just a process that you just have to kind of work with your doctor about and be aware of.
Yeah, I mean, it's what's really difficult, I think, is that I'll see some patients every 3 months, and then from time to time I'll see an adult that I haven't seen in like 3 years. I'm like, where have you been? And they're like, I just got tired of going to the doctor. and their symptoms aren't great, and they kind of like have done really poorly for a couple of years. I'm like, I, you know, because they, it's this is a hard disease to have, right? And I think that people get tired of going to the doctor and finding out like they can't, nobody has a treatment or nothing can be done. But I feel that, symptom management wise, there's hopefully somebody that can help, right? And so I try to really identify like, well, what's the one thing that's bothering you? Oh, well, did you know there's a new pain person? And they don't have to know anything about mitochondrial disease. They just have to be good at managing pain. How about you go give them a try? So it's really just finding that one person that can treat that one symptom. But
And
it's
that's
hard. It gets
really,
exhausting. I mean, it gets you already have fatigue, and then you're like having to go see 16 different doctors for 16 different symptoms.
It's a helpful reminder too, I think, for patients, to talk about your symptoms, the scary ones, the hard ones, and the one, because maybe there are certain symptoms that you can try to see if there's something, that is treatable for the symptom, even though the mito is not itself treatable yet. So another Pete, and I know we're crunched on time, but do we have time for two more questions? Is that okay? Okay. A patient asked, what's the next step for those with mitochondrial dysfunction without a primary genetic diagnosis? Is there anything in the pipeline for that, or is what are your thoughts on that?
So there's two ways to answer that question. One is that if this is somebody who may have a primary mitochondrial disease, we just haven't found the gene yet. We're still working our way through what all of our genes do. And so my answer is reanalysis, reanalysis, right? Like, so, we encourage people to come back every 2 to 3 years, which sounds like forever, right? When we say it, but, we discover these, we discover new things when people come back in 2 or 3 years. We do a new, exome reanalysis, or they may be eligible for genome when they come back, and we discover new things. So to not give up on getting that primary diagnosis. The harder question is, what if somebody has secondary mitochondrial dysfunction and it's not from a primary mitochondrial disease? Because we get asked to see those patients in clinic, and those are harder patients for me to take care of, because my focus is primary mitochondrial disease. That's where my focus is. Those are the patients I want to treat, and I would like to get very good at taking care of that population. And I feel like that, right now, that's where my focus is. And that's where I don't want to use the word struggle, right? But like, we need to get really good at that first. And then maybe we'll have treatments for people with secondary mitochondrial disease. But I feel like we need to get good at the primary mitochondrial disease patients. And then maybe we'll have treatment for secondary mito. But, we have patients that come in that have, long COVID or, something else, and they have secondary mitochondrial dysfunction. And I'm very honest with them. I said, I don't know how to help you, because I am still trying to make sure I can help my patients with primary mitochondrial disease. And, that's kind of where I leave it, because it is, this is tough. The good news for some of those patients is that there are, again, if it's from long COVID, there are long COVID clinics that are open. So I try to see, is there somewhere else they need to be? Is there some category of disease they may have that hasn't been explored? Is it somebody with an autoimmune disease? They have to go back to rheumatology. Is there something else?
No, I really appreciate you sharing your methodology behind that, because it's not that if you don't have primary mitochondrial disease that we don't want to help, right? Like it's that, but if you can focus your energy, then that actually does help in the long run. So it's trying to focus energy to see a bigger picture. The last questions is in regards to AI. Is CHOP considering findings from AI drug repurposing? Are there any initiatives started for this?
Well, I'm not the best person to ask, because I'm not in the drug repurposing world. Dr. Falk, who is the executive director of our program, that's what she does in her lab.
Okay.
Whether they're using AI to help with that or not, I don't know the honest answer. I could guess probably, but she's been doing this for, her whole career, long before
She
AI
is
was around. So
AI.
yeah, right. Yeah, her brain already works like AI. If AI can help with that, great. Maybe they are using it. I'm in another webinar today, and I just heard Ethan Perlstein from Perlara talking about drug repurposing, and I think they're using some AI for that too now. So it's going to be a whole new world, right? If we can use AI to help with that. Yeah, but drug repurposing is fabulous, right? Like if there are drugs that are around, that have been around, and if we can figure out how to use them and in a better way, then that would be wonderful.
Amy, you gave a beautiful explanation before we got started in regards to these changing times that we're in and some of the shifting sands and just bringing hope to our community. In regards to CHOP and CHOP's commitment to the patient community. And I was wondering if you could share that.
Oh, sure, absolutely. There are a number of my colleagues, my friends that are NIH funded. We're all kind of feeling a little bit of the impact of just changing times. And we have a very strong leader at CHOP, our chairman of pediatrics, who has reassured us that if there's anybody who feels concerned about losing funding or anything of that nature, that there's bridge funding available, that CHOP is here to support them. But our mission remains absolutely steadfast. We are here to support the health of children, that we're all here with a shared mission. And that will never change, no matter what's happening politically in the government, no matter what, that we're going through a little bit of a stormy time. But we also have an Office of Governmental Affairs, and they are paying attention to what's being said in Washington and translating it to all of us. But we've been told no one here has to worry at CHOP. We are to remain calm and do our jobs and let the Government Affairs Office figure it out. But we don't have to worry about anything that's happening. Our job is to worry about the children that we're taking care of.
Well, thank you so much. I want to thank both of you guys today for joining us and all of your hard work and everything that you do every day and the commitment that you have to our community and our patients and for taking the time today to bring hope and clarity to our community. We really, really appreciate everything that you're doing. Normally what I do is I just stop right there and I say goodbye, but I did, in the midst of everything that's going on, I did want to babble just a little bit, because I want to make sure that everyone that's in this space or listening to this recording understands that Mito Action's committed to standing alongside of our patients, no matter what changing tides may bring, and that there are numerous safe spaces for you to share, ask questions, give and receive re support. You can obviously always call our Mito 411 line, but also there's a support call every Friday, and anyone and everyone is welcome to attend those support calls for Mito patients. But throughout the month, we also have support spaces geared for specific diagnoses, men and young adults. And also new on our list for the next couple of months is a support call focused on change. Managing change is something that our rare disease community is quite familiar with, whether good or bad, but it can feel a bit jarring and unstabilizing. So whether you're navigating a new symptom, a new diagnosis, new policies, or the impact of a rare disease on your family life, we want to make sure that you know that there's a space that you can set and be encouraged by other people in the midst of murky waters of change. Our next session on change specifically is on March 4th at 6 p.m. And last but not least, I want to make sure that everyone here is aware that on February 23rd, Christine Knox, who is an artist and Mito champion, from 3 to 5 p.m. on Zoom, she will be teaching us how to draw zebras for Rare Disease Day. So I encourage everybody, this is a family activity, a clinician activity. Encourage everybody to come, and together we will be a dazzle because that's what a group of zebras are. And we'll learn to draw zebras. And then for Rare Disease Day, you can hang up your zebra and know that you're standing in solidarity with other patients with rare disease. So thank you so much, everybody, for coming, and thank you for your questions. And we look forward to seeing you next time.
Thank you.
Thanks.